You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We welcome Peter Balakian in conversation with Hovig Chalian. Peter is currently the Donald M. and Constance H. Rebar Professor of the Humanities and Director of Creative Writing at Colgate University. He's widely known for his memoir and nonfiction on the Armenian Genocide. He's the author of the memoir Black Dog of Fate, which is on sale tonight with his new book of poems, which is the winner of the Penn Albrand Prize for Memoir, and The Burning Tigris, the Armenian Genocide, and America's Response, winner of the 2005 Raphael Lemkin Prize. Did any of you know who Raphael Lemkin was? Good. He actually coined the word genocide, Polish Jew. Peter is an accomplished poet. He's the author of 5 books of poetry, and Ziggurat, which is his first book in a number of years, which he'll read from tonight, explores history, self, and imagination, as well as ongoing concerns with catastrophe and with trauma. Many of these new poems wrestle with the aftermath and the reverberations of September 11th, and I think it may bring all of us to thinking about where we were at that time. He does this through layered perspectives of myth, history, and personal memory. The critic Sven Burkertz writes, "Peter Balakian's Ziggurat ingests calamity and dissolves it into almost exhilarating rhythm and image. The work aims to reveal the human capacity to integrate and, after hard passage, to transcend." And our guest tonight, Hovig Chalian, and I want to thank him for all his wonderful efforts to help get the word out about this program, is the co-founder of the Critics Forum. It's a really interesting organization. Check them out online. It's a group of writers, critics, and academics with an interest in English language, Armenian art, and culture in the diaspora. He has a PhD in English from UCLA, and he teaches at USC in the business and engineering schools. And he also wrote a beautiful article about Peter, which was published in Albariz. Thank you for that, Hovig. Without further ado, please welcome Peter Balakian to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Louise, thank you. In fact, I'm incredibly grateful to you for organizing this with me. It seems like we've been emailing for a few months, and of course, probably a half a year, and that's what goes into making any event work well. It's a real treat to be in this forum and to be back in L.A., which is a friendly town to me, and in part, the Armenian community is always a great welcoming force. I'm grateful to Hovig, wherever he is. He'll be here shortly. Hovig, for being part of this tonight and for your terrific work as a critic and a scholar. And the Armenian organizations that have come together with Aloud, Hamaskayin, Asparez, ANC, and anyone else I'm missing, thank you. Thank you for your ongoing support. Now, we're going to try to read. I'm going to read for 32 and a half minutes, and then we're going to have conversation. You know, I know that some of you in the room know my work from my prose books that deal with the Armenian Genocide and my interests in engaging history, issues of memory, cultural landscapes, traumatic aftermaths of disaster. Those kind of percolations move in and out of my poems, and of course have to be part of the ball of wax of the prose books, given what they have dealt with. These aren't the only things I write about. I mean, I always like to, you know, note that I began as a Jersey nature poet a while ago. And anyway, my imagination connects with various dimensions of human experience, but I suppose the trauma and memory, certain kinds of cultural landscapes and history have engaged me in certain kinds of ways. And my new book of poems, Ziggurat, does engage those matters again in certain ways. Some of the poems in the book are set in New York City between the mid-60s and about halfway through this past decade, 2005, 2006. And some of the poems do wrestle with some of the dimensions of the aftermath of the 9/11 disaster. And I want to say something about how I got engaged with thinking about the absence in the city in the years following the disappearance of the towers. I began my first job. You all remember your first job, the job that kind of got you out from under your parents' wing. You went out in the world and you started earning your own money. Well, the first time that happened for me, I was 16, and I got a job at the tip of Manhattan. Some of you know Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, the financial district. I was at 17 Battery Place, okay, really at the tip. If you walked, 100 yards from my office building, you were in the Hudson River. You looked out to the Statue of Liberty. You looked out to Staten Island. You looked out to Jersey on the west. And I was a mail runner. That's M-A-I-L. I ran mail for a stevedoring company, and my primary job was to get checks of a couple hundred. These were $200,000 to $300,000 checks. This was the mid-1960s, late 60s. Those checks today are million-plus dollar checks. A lot of money, as they say, from the steamship companies, Chilean Line, Peralta, MOSK, Cunard, and so forth, to get checks from those companies into the bank before 3 o'clock for my company, because the interest you cost your company, that in lost interest, I should say, the money you cost your company in lost interest by not getting those checks in the bank in time was significant. So they hired somebody just to do that. And at the time, I was a high school football player. I was a running back. And this was also fun for me. I would, I was like kind of whipping around these narrow, crooked, broken Lower Manhattan streets. Okay, if you know that part of the city, it's different from the grid of Midtown. And I got to know the city intimately, that part of the city, Wall Street, Trinity, Greenwich, Maiden Lane, Ant Street, of course, Broadway, Lower Broadway, and so on. And especially those elevators, those marvelous accordion, those 1920s heavy metal accordion elevators with the cigar smoking elevator operators, there was a kind of zone you lived in if you did this kind of weird job. So among, you picked up a lot of I picked up a lot of life. I grew up in an affluent suburban town in northern Jersey, Tenafly. Anybody from Bergen County out here? All right. And so this was an immersion in the real world for me. I worked this job for almost a decade. I would do this job during college years, right even into early years of graduate school and so forth. One of the things that was happening while I was working was the construction of the World Trade Towers. And of course, construction in a city, that's part of, reality. Big deal. But this was a kind of interesting thing to watch. I watched the ground get broken in 1966. I delivered mail to the North Tower, within days of it of the tower's first 49 floors opening for business. And you were delivering mail to the towers while they were being built. It was pretty cool. So again, one doesn't think a lot about it. It's the city, it's life, it's construction, it's building. But when the towers went down on September 11th, 2001, I did find myself in the ensuing year and years really kind of haunted by them, because I did spend a lot of time in them, in a strange way that a messenger spends time in spaces. And they came back to me and interested me, and they were my way into thinking about the aftermath of this event. And as I began to explore them, they turned into other dimensions. I'll say something about that as I read some poems. I began this book with a series of poems called Mail Runner World Trade Center blank. You know, I'll fill it in, you'll see. A week, maybe less than a week after the catastrophe, I got a phone call from an editor asking me if I would write something. He was calling, you know, a couple dozen writers for an anthology. And I said, okay, sure. I said okay, actually quite ambivalently, knowing really that I probably wouldn't write anything because it was too difficult to kind of take this stuff in. But it did get me on a train in central New York. I teach at Colgate University, which is smack in the geographical center of the state of New York. And our nearest train station is in a city called Utica. And I took the train, the Amtrak, down from Utica to New York City to see it. And so, and you could still smell, you know, burning flesh and hair and synthetic materials in the air. It was pretty extraordinary. A while after that, a poem came out of that and turns out to be the first poem in this book called Going to Zero. And the only thing I'll note here is Helen Frankenthaler, the abstract expressionist painter. You probably know of her. She appears in this poem. Seeing the transformation of the culture was something I wanted to get my lines around. I mean, I think a poet is always interested in getting his lines in sync with the kind of music the particular imaginative engagement is making. Going to Zero, one. A canvas with less turpentine, more hard edges, less bleeding. That was good for beauty. Frankenthaler in Art News, in the dining car, crammed with parkas and laptops, microwaved cellophane, plastic plates and canvas bags. And the valley under fog as the cows disappeared. And when the green came back into view, I could see the SUVs floating on the thruway, the cows oblivious to the revved engines of trucks. The river glistened all the way to Albany, and I could see flags on Baptist churches and resurrection trailers. God Bless America on pickups, United We Stand laminated to billboards as the fog settled, then lifted. And when I woke, a flag the size of a football field hung from the gray tower of the GW where the tractor trailers jammed beneath its hem as something sifted down on the silver-plated Hudson. And then the lights went out. Two. The faces on 7th Avenue blurred in the chaos of vendors and liberty scarves, freedom ties, glowing plastic torches, dollars and polyester. And inside Macy's, I was hit by cool air as Stars and Stripes Forever floated down from women's fashions into the quiet aisles of Aramis and silk scarves. I wanted to buy the Frankenthaler. A modest early print, minimal, monochromatic, surface and perspective and dialogue, on 24th off 10th. The gallery still smelled like wood and plaster. But I didn't stop, and when the train reached the stock exchange, the Yom Kippur streets were quiet, and the bronze statue of Washington was camouflaged by National Guard. I was walking my old mail route now, like a drunk knocking into people, almost hit by a cab, until the roped-off streets cut me at the arm. At Broadway and Liberty, the fences wound around the bursts of dust rising over the cranes and bulldozers, over the punched-out windows. I stared through a piece of rusted grid that stood like a gate to the Crystal River. I was sweating in my sweatshirt now, the hood filling with soot, as I watched with others drinking Cokes and eating their pizza of disbelief. Zero began with the Sumerians, who made circles with hollow reeds in wet clay and baked them for posterity. At Broadway and Liberty, at 20 floors charred and standing, at Miasma, people weeping, Anna's Nail Salon, Daiichi Sushi, the vacant shop stripped clean in the graffiti of dust-coated windows. Something blasted from a boombox in a music store. Something, in the ineffable clips of light, disappeared over the river. So I mentioned a group of these World Trade Center mail runner poems. This one is called World Trade Center Black Holes 74. And just to say briefly that the towers, you know, as I reimagined them, they came to embody, you know, mental spaces, spaces that, you know, took on dimensions of sound, perspective, imagination. I may have flunked physics, but I was full of black holes and wind that was slamming the tower. As I rose in the glass box up to the 80th with a check from Chilean Line. Black holes opened relativity, created frozen stars. In the sky lobby on the 99th, I loafed over headlines of John Dean's testimony and the suicide of a CEO. I heard the relativity of the wind. Everything was like. I was trapped in similes I hated. I couldn't leave my head, and so the sound was insidious, then beautiful. Then it was there. If I say I once heard birdbone pipes in an old church in the Caucasus, like this wind blowing in the tracery of the top floors, in the pipelines and farther up. Through the glass, I could see the other tower wavering, the silver like broken mica. I was falling matter, dislodged by the idea of a place from which nothing can return. Jackie Wilson's tremolo, Paganini's broken wires, the frantic shaking of the small bells at the altar, going up into some place beyond the smudged-out sky, above the radar needle, above the planes coming out of the fog on their way to Newark. It was possible to hoist an object out of a black hole with a rope, this bit of knowledge I was hanging on to. Now there's a long poem in the middle of this book. It's a 43-section poem. And just want to note here that the long poem, you know, is a kind of subgenre of its own, in especially in American literature. And anybody who writes in the long poem form owes something of course, to Whitman's Song of Myself, the first great long poem in the modern idiom, which is to say a poem made up of fragmented sequences that splice and interlock with each other. There's much to say about the genre of the form. How many people have read Song of Myself? Yeah, good, great, beautiful, all right. And, you know, this is I think the long poem, you know, in some ways really is deeply American, the way the cheeseburger and the skyscraper and baseball and the suspension bridge are. There's a lot to say about why I think that, but, you know, maybe Hovig and I will talk about that afterward. So, okay, this poem, 43 sections. There are four things kind of stranding, if you will, in this poem. The persona, you know, because, of course, you know, the poem may come out of some autobiographical things, but poetry is fiction. The persona is on a train, on the A train. You all know that great train, that subway line in Manhattan that goes from north to south on the west side. He's on the A train reading a book. And the book is about the excavation of the ziggurat at Ur. I have to say, when this book went into production, people started asking me about the title of the book, what's the name of the book. I'd say Ziggurat. And I get a lot of blank stares, which, of course, made me feel very, very uncomfortable that I had indeed come to a point in life where I had given a title to a book of mine that many people didn't know the meaning of. Anyway, yeah, everybody knows the ziggurat. The ziggurat at Ur, of course, right, was the great building, the first great skyscraper, if you will, in Western civilization, built by the Sumerians, you know, about 2000 BC, in what is today southern Iraq. It's an Aramaic word, and it just means great building. So the guy on the train is reading about Sir Leonard Woolley, the great British archaeologist who excavated the ziggurat at Ur in the late 20s and early 30s and wrote a really brilliant memoir. And it's worth reading, Ur of the Chaldees. So this guy's in the train, he's reading about the excavation of the ziggurat at Ur, and he's dreaming back to a time when he lived in Manhattan, a relationship that went bust, that's connected to the city and where he and she were living then. And also back further, even to his mail running days when he watched the towers go up. And at some point in the consciousness of the persona, a former student of his, he gets news that a former student of his, who's now the ABC anchorman, is nearly killed when an IED blows up in his face as he's covering the Iraq war. In one moment in the poem, the towers do go down. So these things are interlocking, and they're moving in and out of each other in strange and sinuous ways. I want to just read, you know, six sections to give you a taste of this poem, which I hope you will enjoy kind of chewing on when you read it. A Train Ziggurat Elegy 1. The tender head of the he-goat on the cover stares through the branches of a golden tree, and I'm just moving on a system of fuses while the fruit stands of Spanish Harlem fly above. And even now, remembering when we were here after Nixon waved goodbye and rose in the chopper, even now seeing it through the double glass as Ur of the Chaldees revised and updated Sir Leonard Woolley's excavations at Ur, flares on the yellow cover in the momentary dark that wrapped our bodies all night like violent paint on the sheets, like the broken fire escape of our building. At 125th, the guy next to me reading Another Country, the white guy passed out in a suit and a brown bag. The steel screeches the tracks and the vaults light up. Section 4. I ran mail a whole summer down Greenwich and West before it even started. Before we roamed Radio Row for 78s of Ellington and the Blanton Trio. Before the yin-yang of real estate, under the Kentset skies over the river. The wrecking balls took Radio Row down. Florists, groceries, record shops, restaurants, the whole mid-century slid into a pit, and the sun made gothic trees of the falling windows. Out of res ipsa loquitur, out of Port Authority and Chase, Rockefeller and Tobin, the Twin Towers rose from the garbage. 7. We met on a cold morning when the women were gathering dew. Start again. We met at a party in a loft on Green Street in the no gravity of Barsamian's big canvases. Post Magritte, you called it, a vagina and no head, breasts but no limbs. The red wine was Chilean. This was after Allende and Neruda. I watched your mouth in the dark reflection of the window beyond which the light of the towers glared the black red. But still the need to ask, who wrapped the day in nectar? Who cracked the sun over the hedges? Who saw the light flare off the towers at dusk? What's loss if not an open grave where the heart's eaten by worms? I'm going to skip to section 22. Just a quick note here. Caracci refers to the late Renaissance painters of those great Baroque ceilings. When I read this on NPR on September 11, actually, I started getting emails asking me what a city from Pakistan was doing in this poem. And I actually had to respond saying, no, it's the painters. On the street, I heard that the Indians were like cold-blooded dancers at high altitudes, Mohawks who had come down from Canada. I watched them glide with hot rivets and cold steel into the azure of near oblivion. Some days they disappeared in light as if the narrow beams of air came undone, and they floated between steel and blue like lost angels of the Karachi. My head spiraled from the fumes of coffee and yellow bulls, red cranes, green trucks, pale blue drilling rigs, bull's liver, gooseneck, clamshell, orange peels, 192,000 tons of steel. Section 27. It was true. The Armenians got to Jesus first, at least officially, ahead of Rome. And this devastated you because you had believed all those truths of catechism, all that dogma which spelled backwards is humiliation and extravagance, the kind of thing Fellini made you see in Roma. And we left the Angelica laughing at your confirmation dress and your mother's anxious rosary you carried in your purse. And 28, this will be the last from this. But in 28, you know, the towers go down in the mode that most of us received the experience, which is on TV, and the complexity of that kind of virtual disengagement, engagement, I don't know, removed witnessing, call it what you will. A lot has already been written about it. But here, just a simple section, 28. Who is the other who floats between what you see and what is there? Think of the other going silent. Screen fuzz, smoke, hours away on TV, came as dumb smoke into my house. The jade plant leaves, tongue of the cat, pan on the stove, the cardamom and clove moved in their currents. Outside, the sky was searing blue, honeysuckle wafting through. There was nowhere to go. Sat down, got up, stared at the iBook, walked around. No phone service. The cell's dead, too. Okay, I'm going to close here with two poems. One, I would like to just shift gears for 1 second. I'll shift gears for the last poem. I'll finish with one other poem from the Ziggurat book. To say very briefly, I got interested in the course of writing this book in Andy Warhol's silk screens. A group of them in particular. They allowed me to continue to pursue my kind of obsession with history. And, you remember the early Warhol silk screens when he was working off of kind of edgy contemporary events, an electrocution, a car accident, a race riot, and he was doing something, of course, complicated with the form and new with the vision. So for me, the Warhol silkscreens became a kind of mediating zone through which I could engage the work of art, but also find another perspective into history that I could intersect with in ways that were slightly personal. This one is called Warhol Electric Chair 63. I couldn't end a reading on an electric chair, so I can't make it the last poem. It's a green and red, it's the green and red silk screen, if you know it. And it was done to commemorate what was thought to be at the time the last act of capital punishment in New York State, up in Sing Sing, which is the name of a town up the Hudson River. You'll catch the Beatles thing near the end of the poem, I'm sure. And the Caucasian rug is an Armenian. These are Armenian village rugs that have brilliant, gorgeous greens in them. Warhol Electric Chair 63. The red spreads like Christmas wrapping. The green, a field in a Caucasian rug. It's almost beautiful without the metal plates for the head, though the plug on the floor is visible. Before decorator colors in Hockney, Calvin Klein in the summery Hamptons, before there were switches to break the flow, my mother used to say, never touch a radio when you're in the bathtub. Never fly a kite near transmission lines. But still, it's furniture. Still, it's a typical American way to go. It's Sing Sing, the silhouette of Ethel Rosenberg. In the rheostatic air, the absent man heard, "She loves you." The British invasion and the flat line arrived at once. Outside, Negroes were eaten by dogs. Johnson was sworn in. Cuba turned red in the green sea. And I want to close with a poem from my New and Selected. It's a poem from the new section of the New and Selected called In Armenia, 1987. And I have this poem on my mind because I'll be going to Yerevan in a couple of weeks to a genocide conference, and I'm jogged back to my first engagement with the land and the landscape of this small but very rich, culturally rich, landlocked country that is, as many of you know here, the kind of remains of the aftermath of genocide, Historic Armenia, of course, was much larger and occupied much of what is today central and eastern Turkey. One is struck by the cultural richness of artifacts and architecture of these extraordinary churches built in the 8th and 9th and 10th century out of the landscape, a kind of thing that Frank Lloyd Wright would have heartily embraced had he ever seen them. I'm not sure he knew about them. The poem also kind of brushes with the southern border that bumps against Turkey, the perpetrator of the Armenian genocide of 1915, at a place called Sardarabad, where the Armenians fought to keep whatever was left alive and intact. And khachkars are these extraordinary Armenian works of art. They are stone crosses, and the carving in them is so fine it almost looks like lace, and I'm not exaggerating. If you haven't seen a khachkar, fly to Armenia and see one, or go to the Met in New York, because there's one there. In Armenia, 1987. Into a basalt cavern I wandered, where the moon slid like a water snake in white skin through the gullies to the blonde and furry wheat. I dug toward the damp smell of a water channel, found a shard of a cross, its lacework a system of streams wound into stone. Grapes and pomegranates and grapes, pulpy in my hands. Palmettos sawed my palms. A rising moon in the moss-grown stone mirrored the light, where winged griffins, those talismans of blood, flew into the arms of Christ. Down a gully like a volute, I found a way to the dry clay of the border, where a scimitar cut the horizon. Pegasus flew out of the tufa walls into the white shroud of Ararat, and the ringing bells slid into the scree. Down there, I felt my name disappear. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. So, Peter, I'd like to start off by saying I'm delighted to be here to talk about your latest volume of poems, Ziggurat. I want to start off by kind of putting some of the poetry in the larger context of your career over the last 20 or 30 years. Most of you will probably know that Peter started off as a poet. You mentioned this earlier. So your first book of poems was in 1979, Father Fisheye, if I'm not mistaken. So for the next 20 years, Peter wrote in largely one genre, in poetry. What's remarkable about his work is that he spanned several genres afterwards. So in the late 1980s came the memoir Black Dog of Fate, which was mentioned earlier, very well received both critically and from a popular perspective. And in the mid-2000s came an entirely different genre, that of history, with Burning Tigris, which most of you are probably also familiar with, the Armenian Genocide and America's Response. The three genres are very, very different, from my perspective, this book of poems, in a sense, brings all three together. So this was published in September of 2010, this year, not coincidentally because of the connections to the September 11th attacks 9 years earlier. What I want to start with is kind of a simple question. From my perspective, like I said, the three genres kind of come together in Ziggurat. There is there are pieces of personal experience here, though they're the speakers fictionalized in the form of a speaker, but based on your own experience. There are pieces of history that break through both the Armenian genocide as well as other atrocities and catastrophes across history and culture. So there are references to other genocides, the Cambodian, for example, and of course the form itself is that of poetry. So the simple question I wanted to start off with to get us going is, why did you choose to write about this particular set of experiences in this particular form? Why poetry primarily?
Well, I guess, Hovig, you know, the poem is where I've always lived. It's really, I mean, my prose books were sort of deviations off of my main river, you know, of imagination and language and form. But I'd also say that certainly writing, for me, writing a memoir was in large part, you know, a kind of challenge because I really work out of image, musical phrase, and it was quite hard to write a memoir because I wasn't used to telling a story in the way that prose, narrative, plot, direction, you know, demands. So Black Dog of Fate was twice the size when I wrote it. I chopped it. It was, you know, it was a denser prose, poem, lyrical text. But, you know, I had to figure out another thing, and that is storytelling. So that's just a kind of aside that for me, you know, the gears haven't been switched too much. They have stayed in the lyrical mode of the compressed phrase of language, the intensified image exploration. The Ziggurat collection, you know, came out of, as I was mentioning earlier, you know, a kind of sense of haunted landscape, place I had known, worked in, lived in, came back to me in a kind of interesting, oblique, and weird way that I felt I could personally, you know, thread a needle with. You know, I had no intention of trying to write about a great disaster, you know, and I don't think this book does that, but it engages the landscape. It engages the materiality of architecture, of kind of artifact, structure, form, and a personal lived life in a big urban center during the course of a span of decades. So without the personal feeling of connection, you know, this book wouldn't have gone the way it went. And I kind of have been pushing on the long form for a long time. There's a long poem, a collage-like poem in my 1983 book of poems, Sad Days of Light, called The Claim, in which I take a legal suit, my grandmother's human rights lawsuit against the Turkish government, and I kind of crack it open. It was a sort of a Poundian idea of cracking open a kind of text from another genre and grinding it into something. And there was another poem in the new section of Juntry called Night Patio, which is trying to deal with post-World War II America. And so the impulse to go further with a 43-section poem was something that's kind of been building for a long time. So that was another impulse, the long poem impulse. And I kind of like the form. I plan to keep writing in it, I suppose.
Well, it's not easy writing the long poem, especially these days. You don't see too many of them.
There are. I mean, a lot of contemporary poets work in a long poem form. You know, Ashbery, Jory Graham, trying to think, C.D. Wright. I mean, just things come to mind. Walcott has written some immense, you know, they're a little different in that they're more narrative. But I think the long poem, don't underestimate the long poem. It's a very rich, I think, form, and what's appealing about it is also I don't know, there's more elbow room. You don't have to kind of nail everything in the containment of a lyric poem. You can let things reemerge in other sections of the poem, you know, as the poem emerges. So, you know, I was mentioning Whitman, but, you know, you can think of Hilda Doolittle, H.D.'s Trilogy, or Pound's Cantos, or Eliot's Wasteland, or William Cross Williams's Passion. There's a whole tradition of modernism kind of burst the cap off the long poem, but I think poets have run wild with it in our time. I'm certainly not unique in this way, but...
To build off of that, I think you mentioned earlier what we were talking about, and I mentioned the separate genres of history, memoir, and poetry. Part of what you get in history, we were talking about this earlier too before the program, you have chronology and sequence. You have things that sort of fall into place and order. The advantage of a poem like this and a long poem is you have the ability to jump back and forth, not worry so much about sequence and history. There are connections that the mind makes or that poetry is allowed to make that history doesn't really have the authority to do in the same way. Part of what you get in reading the entire poems, I read them through again earlier today, you get less of it in reading excerpts of it, is the connections you get back and forth. So you read something on page 4 or in the third stanza, you go forward another 10 or 12 pages, you see kind of a connection back and forth between the two. You were mentioning Warhol's lithos. Part of what jumps out at me about Warhol's lithos is that they're kind of repetitions of the same thing over and over again in different form. They remind me of those books we used to have as kids, that kind of a modern palimpsest where you would draw on the surface of it and it would carbon copy down two or three layers, you get a different version of the same thing. Part of what's rich about this poem, it's 70 some odd, the poem is in 70 pages, but the collection is 70 pages, is the connections you can make across them. Is that something that you try to kind of exploit in the form? Is that something that you do in a natural way, or do you kind of spend a lot of time crafting that part of it?
You're talking about the poem or the whole book?
Well, primarily the poem at the center of it, but there, if you read it through several times, you see connections across the various parts of the entire collection.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it'd be interesting to get 10 people up here, 10 poets up here, who've worked in that form. I mean, I suppose for me, it's a little bit like blocking a play. You block it. I mean, you're really interested. You really work. You know, you work at figuring out how you want the various strands to continue to play off each other at various intervals. And as you were noting, I think, or suggesting, the interest is not in linearity in any traditional way. It's in lyrical and non-linear psychology and time. And the lyric poem opens itself up to that very much. I think it's not far from certain ways in which cinema works. If you think about the form of film, you know, that it's working by a kind of editing process that is metonymous, and that is, you know, very much alive in the way my own notion of this form works.
Yeah, and I also see, I mean, to kind of complete the point, I also see bits of memoir in here, and a lot of what comes through in my reading of it at least is the fact that the connections that are being made are almost the connections that we make in our own memories. So when you remember something, you don't remember it as having happened after this or before that. You remember it in a kind of jumble in your own mind. Of course, as a poet, you craft that, but there are bits of it that sort of come through that way. There are memories, whether you want to think of it as a personal one or a collective one, but there are connections we make across events that don't quite happen in the same way across history. It's very much sort of the stuff of memoir.
Well, memory, of course, freezes time, in my view, you know, and here the fundamental dimensions of poetic form really can dovetail with memoir as a form too. I mean, in writing a memoir, you know, I just froze the past and dug lyrically. Now this was very irritating to my editor, because she's saying to me, you just can't go that far and deep with that particular moment of looking at that painting, you know. And I'd have to decide, am I going to be cooperative or pissed off about it, you know. I struck a balance that worked for me, you know. If I wanted to stay with something lyrically and be more prose poetic with it, I would. But I also did recognize that memory works lyrically and internally and, if you will, vertically. You know, I'm using that as a kind of loose metaphor. Rather than, if horizontal means linearity, memory time goes down, pries open, and spreads. And so poetic language is built out of that. So, yes, there are the memory sections for the persona and the long poem often get you in lyric expansion. And, you know, that's a lot of where the heart and soul of it, of the kind of writing I like to do is.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think the metaphor of excavation and digging comes up again and again in the poem. So, for example, you mentioned Woolley earlier, who was excavating at Ur. There are parts of his memoir that come through the poetry, both explicitly and implicitly. You also talk about, and I'll find the sequence in a second. You also talk about 9/11 as kind of almost a perverse excavation. You talk about in the poem the hole that's left after the explosion as kind of almost a form of excavation itself. You also talk about the fact that it's built on a hole. It's built on sort of garbage, and I'll find the poem in a bit. But what's the connection for you there?
Well, precisely as you're putting it, I mean, what interested me about the ziggurat at Ur in some way is that it was a significant work of cultural achievement that vanished. And then, you know, 4,000 years later, it's dug up in fragments and shards, but we came to reconstruct it in our imaginations. You know, the Tower of Babel is another ziggurat, okay? And we have that. We have some of these images in our imagination, and I got interested in the reappearance after absence and reappearance in imagination. And how, you know, imagination allows us to create continuity between historical epochs. So the idea of ziggurat became a trope for great building in the modern era, obviously, for the towers. The towers were extraordinary. You know, as I came to think about the towers, too, I really felt Yamasaki had done just such a brilliant job of creating this austere, late modernist minimalism out of those ribboning steel bands that made those continuous eyelets of windows go up 100-plus floors, and two of them, you know, wavering in their silver as the sun often would hit it off the Hudson. It was quite, you know, again, aesthetically quite remarkable. They also embodied some things that are quite complex and irritated parts of the planet. That's another interesting dimension of it to me, too, as international capital of a certain kind, you know.
The way you describe it, there's almost a beauty, but the kind of beauty that you imagine kind of going away eventually. You describe, for example, the music that you hear in the elevators as you go up,
right.
The fact that it kind of carries across to jazz music and other associations, the music in the church that you mentioned earlier.
Right.
So all of those things kind of come through the structure itself and its mechanical beauty.
I'm sure the Armenian audience picked up the bird bone pipes in a church in the Caucasus.
I hope so.
Right. They became, for me, obviously, fictive places of imagination. I mean, you won't come away from the poems thinking they're empirical. They may begin in some empirical place, but they end up somewhere else. So that was a lot of fun, you know.
I'm gonna read the section I was thinking about earlier, just to kind of come back to the same idea. So this part of this you read earlier, florists, groceries, record shops, restaurants, the whole mid-century slid into a pit, and the sun made Gothic trees of the falling windows. Out of res ipsa loquitur, out of Port Authority and Chase, Rockefeller and Tobin, the Twin Towers rose from the garbage. And there's a reference earlier when I was talking about sort of the connections across the poem. You talk about filling up the hole, the poem talks about filling up the hole left by the garbage of history. So in my mind, you see things rising up. You see all of these architectural structures rising up as, you know, perhaps signs of pride or hubris. You mentioned that in a number of places as well. But the whole mid-century itself is morally sliding into a pit. So there's a kind of a rising up physically in terms of the structures, but morally, poetically, representationally, there's a kind of a sliding down the ladder of history.
Well, you're being the critic now, so I'm going to let you do that. But I don't want to be that interpretive. You know, I just wrote it. So, but I'm grateful for your insights. I mean,
So I'm going to take one more bit of critical license here. Another excerpt here. You talk about it was the precise and chaotic digging into the beginning. This is Woolley. As if the piece of the snake's tail that was swallowed by the mouth made the full circle of history. Part of, again, this may be kind of an idiosyncratic reference that I'm making, but there's an old Arthurian legend of Camelot being built again and again and having it fall down. And I think the third time they bring Arthur and they dig down and they find two dragons, each biting the other's tail, which is supposed to be an image of sort of warring factions at the time. But there's something similar going on in your poem. There's a history that kind of repeats itself endlessly, and there's a kind of almost an original sin built into the building of the building.
You know that Hovig is trained as a medievalist, which is really terrific. You know, he has a PhD in medieval literature, and yet he writes brilliantly about contemporary culture. And so I'm interested to hear about the Arthurian trope. I didn't know about it.
I'm not claiming it's actually in here. This is mine.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm certainly interested in absence and regeneration, recovery. But sometimes, you know, recovery, I guess I'm kind of asking questions in this book about what's sustainable in human enterprise and what imagination might accomplish in an age of uncertainty like ours. I think we have to acknowledge the kind of shaken parameters that we kind of walk around in. And I think probably the attacks of September 11, implode in our cultural experience in a certain way now, a decade later. So I got interested in that. The Ouroboric, you know, that's a Jungian image too of the snake eating its tail as a symbol of the beginning and the end and the coming together of time and a unity. So I do have a couple of Ouroboric moments in there. Yeah.
And last question on this, just to make it kind of more practical. So can you tell us a little bit about the history of the you talk in the poem about the fact that the sort of the underground was dug out for the foundation to be built 70 feet deep, and part of the extension of Manhattan Island was built on the garbage. I don't know how many people know that reference as a more kind of more practical touch point, let's say, in the poem.
Well, again, I suppose I read a lot about the building of the towers and about Manhattan Island, and one gets struck by the kinds of strange, sometimes perverse ingenuities we as human beings have in our almost restless and indefatigable will to keep, you know, creating. I think of that phrase that Merwin used not too long ago in a little anthology of his, Lament for the Makers, but, you know, he wanted a folk, I know it refers back to a Scottish 18th century anthology, Lament for the Makers, but makers, poets, architects, constructors of urban places. Sometimes it's bad and perverse, but it forces us to wrestle with the meaning of human making. So, you're noting some of the underbelly of that making. And we're stuck with it. It's paradoxical, it's ironic. One can play with it as one wishes, but it does remind us of what we, in the broadest sense, as makers of civilization, often do.
Makers and unmakers, perhaps.
Yeah, makers and unmakers. We're certainly doing plenty of unmaking as we're making, and that's really, that's a whole weekend seminar on a lot of things that have to do with the fate of the planet, making and unmaking.
Mm-hmm. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the more historical references in the poem as well, and kind of pull out to some of the other issues. Again, you mentioned that a lot of people in the audience are Armenian. There are references to the Armenian genocide, as you mentioned earlier, as well as other atrocities, Rwandan, Cambodian, etc. And again, this is my reflection on the poem, but as a jumping off point for you. So a couple of things that I saw that connected in the poem. You talk early on, or the poem talks early on, about the digging up of the Sumerian ruins and the finding of the ziggurat at Ur. And the description is, all the bodies lay on their backs, rigidly extended, hands crossed below the stomach, the graves dug into the silt were, and continues. So these are the graves that are being dug up of the ziggurat at Ur, and there's a reference later, of course, to the digging up of Armenian bones. So the reading, I'll give it to you briefly, is, you forget that Nebuchadnezzar inherited the region a millennium later. This is the region of the ziggurat. You forget because it's just an excavation now, like my mind when it blanks into itself, like the horizon when it goes black, and the flame of one oil refinery flickers out at the Syrian border, where once I picked Armenian bones out of the dirt. The reference to the desert of Derzor, where a lot of Armenians died in 1915, 1916. The connection, again, is across time, across cultures, across context.
I think that's one of the most appealing and dynamic parts of poetry. And, I don't know how many deep poetry readers there are in the audience. I hope you all are. But the way that the lyric can pole vault or catapult across many kinds of linear spaces in non-linear ways, so that in a few lines you can find yourself moving between an Armenian genocide image, a Syrian desert image, a Nebuchadnezzar moment, and Sumerian moment. So you're able to move if you can, you work your own music pacing in your lines. A lot of things can happen in that way, and that's really a lot of fun. And I hope for readers it's engaging. Should we be heading out to the audience?
I think Luis had five more minutes.
Let's turn it over to the audience.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask my last question, and it's sort of a big one, and it might be a good lead into some of the questions. So you talked about the long form earlier. Part of the reason I brought up the fact that the long form is used a little less, it's not used less, but it's a difficult medium to work in, is because it asks big questions. So, for instance, you talk about the Armenian genocide, other large historical issues, and the simple question I want to close with is, considering the fact that you're talking about what you've called in other places an age of uncertainty, the consciousness that you're kind of presenting and discussing, the speaker who speaks in the poem is one who kind of suffers from a fractured modern consciousness. Your poetry has also been described, and your writing in general has been described, as a poetry and a writing of witness. How do you reconcile, how do those two things work together? How can you be, not you personally, but how can we write a poetry of witness in an age of uncertainty? How do we do that?
Well, the word witness is fraught with a lot of semiotic issues, and I think that poets observe carefully, clearly, closely, in economical language, in compressed language. I think poems can come along in the aftermath, in this case, and poems do many, many things with human experience and for our human experience, but poems can come along in the aftermath of a large event, a catastrophic event, and catch something, you know, just something, a filament or a trace in a particular, what I would say, speech, tongue, voice, syntax, so that the music of the language is embodying something of the aftermath of this event. I mean, one asks oneself, well, what would we, and it's a different kind of poetry, it's narrative, but, you know, what we know about the Trojan War, we know from Homer and the music and language he made out of the event. Now, you can take Homer and just unspool one piece of the poem's function in culture and civilization, and you can find it, you know, again and again, down to Yeats, down to Auden, down to Robert Lowell. So you, you know, I want to think of witness not in any way that interferes with the primary experience of those who suffered enormous cruelty, but with the poet as a clear-eyed seer in cold light who's able to capture some things in an intensified way so that images stay with you. And they haunt, you know. That's Bob Haas's phrase, which I like. They images haunt, and some of the power of poetry remains in that dynamic.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter.
So yes, please, audience, yeah.
It's open to questions. That's right. We'll wait a few seconds for people to catch their breath.
Yes.
Well, I've read your books about Armenia and your memoir, and I was wondering what do you consider your relationship with contemporary Armenia? Is it usually in the context of the Armenian genocide and your writings on that, or you mentioned that you're going to a conference there soon? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like much? Do you feel much of a connection to the country as it exists now, or is it more of an association with the past and with history and culture?
Well, it's a great question, and there's not enough time for me to fully, you know, reflect on it. But I, you know, maybe the last poem I read, it was an attempt to suggest that the culture is very much alive in its artistic dimensions, in its historical richness, in its land and landscape. That's one relationship I have with the place. I also have other relationships with the place and its social dimensions. I'm on the board of the Children of Armenia Fund. I'm interested in some of the, you know, I want to go visit some of the sites of the projects in hospitals and schools that COAF is now working on. So, you know, I think one's engagement with a place as complicated as Armenia, small as it may be, complicated, a miraculous emanation of civilization that, against all odds, is here, you know. So it's artistic, it's cultural, and as much and more that I might be able to make it, it will also be social and humanitarian as in my own, whatever small way I'm capable of being involved. I do have one book out in Armenian. Black Dog of Fate is out in Armenian, and that was a fun experience to go there when that book came out and kind of really talk to various layers of the country. But God knows there are a lot of problems to solve there. But I do think we want to focus on the stunning cultural achievements that exist in the land and landscape, and I'd like to see more of that be turned into commerce, frankly, because I think you could bring a lot of people from around the world to spend time in those zones of art and churches. You know, you could have a touch of Florence there.
Question up there. Center of the aisle.
I'd like to ask about the line, "I picked Armenian bones out of the dirt." I'd like to ask about that place along the Syrian border where you did that.
Right.
If you would describe it to us. And is it a protected site? Is it open to anyone? Is it public land? Is it private land? Is it being taken care of?
Right. How are you? Good to see you. It's Syria. You know, it's an authoritarian society. Everything is monitored heavily by the government. It's, you know, many of you understand that. You know, when I went with the 60 Minutes crew to do the segment that you may have seen this past year, it was quite an initiation into, you know, kind of police state society. So it's protected, but not because it's sacred ground. And the places of Armenian cemetery, if you will, genocide cemetery, are in very remote, complicated places that intersect with a lot of the oil refinery and oil excavation areas. So it's really hard to go there. There is one nicely preserved place, some of you I know in this room have been to, Margadeh, the chapel, about, you know, 80 miles south and east of Deir-Zor City. Maybe more, maybe 120 miles south and east of Deir-Zor City. So that spot the Syrian government gave to the Armenians to have a sacred place. But it's nothing like, say, Auschwitz in Poland, you know, or other camps or sites of atrocity that have been, you know, much more deeply cultivated and popularized. That's not the case. So it's pretty haphazard. And you know, if you do get to go to places where you can find skeletal remains of the dead, you know, you have to work hard at it.
You spoke about translation of Black Dog of Fate. could you talk a little bit about the impact of translation in preserving the spirit of your essence?
You mean literary translation?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Literary translation. Yeah, look, this gets me into a longer conversation with the Armenian community, in this case, in my own strong advocacy that we invest resources in cultural production. And translation is one dimension, an important dimension of cultural production. We should have an institute that is continually at work, well-funded, in which great texts, you know, I'd like to read Abovian's The Wounds of Armenia, but I don't read Armenian, and I can't read that book until somebody translates it. The translation projects I've done have all been collaborative, and I've enjoyed them immensely, and I've learned about the language. And, you know, I don't want to get into my self-flagellation about my absence of Armenian fluency, but I hope before I leave the planet I'll know the language well enough. But that's another story. So we need very much to invest in this. You know, I did a collaborative translation of Armenian Golgotha with Aris Sevak, who's a marvelous translator. It was pulling teeth to get the funding to do it, you know? But we have to have this. We have a lot of great texts, and culture lives. Cultures live because of their text. I mean, the most salient example is Jewish culture. You know, without the Bible, try to figure how Jewish culture might have evolved. I mean, it's an interesting hypothetical, you know, thing to think about. But our texts mean a great deal to us, and the texts need to get into other languages, especially, you know, English in this case, lingua franca. You know, we need to get our text there. Charents, Yarjanyan, Tekean, they should be in bookstores in good paperback editions. And there are people out there who want to do it, but we need apparatus, and it starts with funding. So those of you who feel passionate about this, get in touch with me and let's do it. I mean, you don't need me to do it, but I mean, I'm happy to be useful if I can.
Maybe one more question.
Okay. There's one over there.
Thanks for coming, Peter. Is there still something that language can do that images can't, and that poetry can do that movies can't? I'm really interested to know your take on, you know, culture is moving so far away from, you know, poetry and literature. At the same time, I think writers believe there is something very unique to it, very special about it. So can you comment on that?
Well, I would certainly take the, you know, 24-word Emily Dickinson poem in its naked spareness and strange off-rhymed music to the $100 million blockbuster film any day for insight and knowledge and illumination. I really think the poem remains in some way timeless as an art because it always engages a primary human voice. And I always like to recall that the poem takes us back to chant and prayer and dithyramb and song. Its origins are there and its emanations take that much further. And that poets really do make the language music of every era, whether they get credit for it or not, and sometimes is irrelevant. You know, one thinks just sort of immediately, you know, a poem like Ginsberg's Howl. You know, it kind of created a new kind of syntax music that had a big impact on understanding an era. I mean, I think of Eliot's Wasteland in another way and doing the things it did in teaching us how to read again. So the poem will teach us how to make, you know, that kind of primary relationship to knowledge and insight through its particular energized music, which is connected to the historical and creates the historical. And of course, you know, when you think about being bombarded by screens and sound, you realize too that poetry is going to always make you wrestle with silence. And there's nothing, and to go deeper into mind, into psyche, and into other dimensions of otherness, spiritual, political, religious, that's essential. A kind of slow meditative reading. I urge all of you readers, you know, to stay unafraid of that slower time and that silence meditative engagement, because we're so clobbered by mess and noise. And we've got to, you know, poetry is one of the greatest disciplines for the intellect, because it forces us to focus with such fineness.
Louise, do we have time for other questions? Or?
A good ending point.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
A Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.